can roofie me, Bri? All right, Caleb said. All right.
The bartender, Gale's CrossFit addict nephew, Jared, came down the bar, his face tight.
We okay down here? Andrew, Brian said. The gentleman's asking us if we're okay. Are we okay? Tip fucking top,
Andrew saluted the bartender, which pissed Jared off.
Because I can arrange a ride home for you, sir. You follow what I'm saying?
Andrew slipped into a rich British accent.
I do, my good publican, and I'd much prefer not to cross paths with the local constabulary tonight.
Jared told Brian,
get your friend in a cab. You got it.
Jared picked up the glass that had fallen behind the bar. Remarkably, it hadn't shattered.
He's still here. I'm on it, Brian said.
By this point, Andrew had the scowling, inward look of the petulant drunk. In her youth, Rachel had seen her mother and two of her mother's boyfriends sport similar looks as a regretful day crossed the plain into a regrettable night. Andrew grabbed his sport coat off the back of a chair, almost toppling it as well.
You still keep the place in Baker Lake?
Rachel had no idea who he was talking to. His eyes were on the floor.
Let's go, Brian said.
Don't fucking touch me!
Brian held his hands high, like a stagecoach driver in the Old West during a stick-up.
That's some pure fucking wilderness there, Andrew said. But then you always liked the wild, Bri.
He stumbled toward the door, Brian walking behind him, arms still half-raised. On the sidewalk, two things happened almost simultaneously. The cab arrived, and Andrew took a swing at Brian. Brian easily ducked the punch, and then caught a reeling Andrew in his arms like he was catching a woman in an old movie on her way to the fainting couch. He stood him up straight and slapped him in the face. Everyone saw it. They'd been watching the drama unfold since the two of them had exited the bar. A few of the young interns gasped. A few others laughed. One young guy said,
"Shit, don't fuck with the boss man, huh?"
There was something about both the speed and the casual ease of the slap that made it seem twice as brutal. It wasn't the way someone slapped a man who was a threat, but the way someone slapped a child who was an annoyance. There was contempt in it. Andrew's shoulders heaved, and his head bobbed, and it became clear he was weeping. Rachel watched her husband saying something to the cab driver, who was out of his cab and trying to wave off the fare, keep a potentially violent drunk out of his taxi. But Brian handed him some bills, and the cabbie took them. Then they both poured Andrew into the back of the cab, and the cab headed up Tremont. When Brian came back in the bar, he seemed surprised that anyone had been paying attention. He took Rachel's hand and kissed her and said,
"Sorry about that."
Half of her was still back at the slap, the effortless cruelty of it. Who is he? They went to the bar, and Brian ordered a scotch, slipped Jared $50 for his trouble, and turned to her.
He's an old friend. An embarrassing, pain in the ass, never adapted to growing up old friend. You got any of those?
Well, sure. She took a sip of his scotch. Well, I used to.
How'd you get rid of them?
They got rid of me, she admitted. That pierced something in him. She could see the pain find him, and she loved him very much at that moment. He reached out with the same hand that had slapped his friend and caressed her cheek.
Fools, he whispered. They were all fools.
Chapter 18. Culture Shock. She spent the morning after the party googling with a hangover while Brian went for a run along the river. First, she looked up Since I Fell for You. As she'd expected, the first page contained nothing but links to versions of the song. On the second page, she found a reference to an episode of a TV show, L.A. Law, that had been on when she was in grade school. She remembered her mother watching the show religiously, and once putting her hands to her mouth as one of the characters, a woman with tall hair and wide lapels, fell down an elevator shaft. Rachel looked up the Since I Fell for You episode on IMDb, and nothing about the description struck any chords. On the third page, she found a link to a movie from 2002 starring Robert Hayes, Vivica A. Fox, Christy Gale, and Brett Alden, with special appearances by Stephen Dorff and Gary Busey. She clicked on the link and got a 401 message that the site no longer existed. So she opened a fresh window and Googled Since I Fell for You 2002 movie. Even with the added specificity, most of the links that appeared were to the song. Finally, though, one to Since I Fell for You, May-December 2002, VHS, eBay. When she clicked the link, it brought her to eBay and a screenshot of a VHS tape. The enlargement function was for shit, but she did get close enough to make out the two main actors' faces. It took her a minute to recognize the male as the guy who'd starred in Airplane. The female, she was pretty sure, was in Independence Day. She'd played the twit who'd risked everybody's life at one point to save her dog. To the right of the photo was a description, probably pulled from the back of the VHS. Widower Tom, Hayes, finds himself falling for lovely housekeeper LaToya, Fox, who's half his age. Meanwhile, Tom's son, Alden, and LaToya's handicapped roommate, Gale, are also falling for each other in this heartfelt dramedy that asks if love can ever be wrong. Rachel hopped back on IMDb and cross-referenced Robert Hayes's and Vivica A. Fox's credits for other links or information. She found none. She did further due diligence and checked for the title in the credits of Stephen Dorff, Gary Busey, and the two actors she'd never heard of, Christy Gale and Brett Alden. Messrs. Dorff and Busey didn't even list the film in their credits. Christy Gale seemed to have had a blink-and-you'll-miss-it career in straight-to-video and had appeared in only one major theatrical release, Scary Movie 3, as Girl on Unicycle. Her page hadn't been updated since 2007, which was also the date of her last credit, something called Lethal Kill. Was there another kind, Rachel wondered. No page existed for Brett Alden. He must have had his one acrid taste of the off-off-off Hollywood Boulevard life and run back home to Iowa or Wisconsin. Rachel clicked back on the open eBay window and purchased the tape for $4.87 and chose second day air for delivery. She got another cup of coffee and came back to her laptop, still in her pajamas, and looked out at the river. Sometime last night it had stopped raining. And sometime this morning, the sun, yes, the sun, rose. Everything appeared not just clean, but polished, the sky looking like a frozen tidal wave, the trees along the river as sharp as jade. And here she sat indoors, with a hangover that thumped in her head and throbbed in her chest and made every synapse hiccup at least once before it fired. She clicked on her music folder and chose a playlist she'd compiled to chill herself out on days when the nerves were too close to the skin. The National, Lord Huron, Adams for Peace, My Morning Jacket, and others of that ilk, and started looking into Baker Lake. There were three of them, the biggest in Washington State, another in the Canadian Arctic, and a third in Maine. The one in Washington looked touristy. The one in Canada was populated mostly by Inuit, and the one in Maine was wilderness, the nearest town, by the looks of it, 40 miles away. As for proximity to a major city, it was actually closer to Quebec City than Bangor.
Camping trip?
She spun with the chair to face him, Brian, covered in sweat from his run, standing 8 feet behind her, drinking from a water bottle.
Reading over my shoulder? She smiled.
He matched her smile.
Just walked in, happened to see the back of my wife's head and Baker Lake beyond it.
She dug her toe into the rug and swiveled the chair again, back and forth this time.
Your friend mentioned it last night.
Which friend?
She gave him an arched eyebrow.
I had several there last night.
Any others that you bitch-slapped?
Ah.
He took a small step back and another sip of water.
Yes. Ah, what was that about?
He got drunk, nearly got us tossed from our favorite bar, and then took a swing at me on the sidewalk.
Yes, but why?
Why?
He peered at her in a way she found vaguely reptilian.
He's a violent drunk. He always was. So why did Caleb bring him two drinks at the same time?
Because he's Caleb. I don't know, ask him.
It just seems an odd thing to do, give a violent drunk a plethora of liquor as soon as he walks through the door.
Plethora?
She nodded. Plethora. He shrugged.
Again, you'd have to ask Caleb. Maybe next time you guys hang out while I'm away.
She mock-pouted, something she knew irritated him to no end. That threatens you?
Didn't say it did.
A blithe shrug from his broad shoulders, trying to play it cool, while the temperature in the room ticked up 5 degrees.
That you can't trust your partner, she said. Or you can't trust your wife.
I can trust both of you. I just find it odd that you, virtually a shut-in for the last 2 years, hopped a cab to Cambridge and stumbled across my business partner.
I didn't stumble across him. I went to your building. He squatted on the rug and rolled the bottle between his palms.
And why would you do that?
Because I thought you were lying to me.
This again?
His laugh was unpleasant. I guess so.
You understand how nuts you sound?
No. Illuminated for me. He rose up and down on his haunches several times, as if preparing his calves for the blast of a starter's pistol.
You thought you saw me in Boston when I was actually 30,000 feet in the air.
Unless, she crinkled her nose at him, you weren't. He batted his eyelashes at her.
Then you put me through a series of hoops to prove I was actually in London, hoops that I successfully jumped through, but that wasn't enough. You...
He coughed out a laugh of sudden disbelief.
You walk around for the last week giving me looks like I'm the leader of a fucking sleeper cell.
Or, she said, you could be like that guy who pretended to be a Rockefeller.
I could.
He nodded as if that made absolute sense, drained his water.
He killed people, didn't he?
She stared back at him. I believe that he did, yes.
Left the wife alive,
he said. That was sporting of him. She felt an inexplicable smirk tugging at the corners of her mouth.
Stole their kid, but left behind the silverware.
Place settings are important.
Hey.
What?
Why are you smiling?
Why are you?
Because this is so ridiculous.
Beyond the pale, she agreed.
So do we keep circling it?
I don't know. He knelt at her feet, took her hands in his, looked in her eyes.
I flew out of Boston last Monday on British Airways.
You don't have to.
The flight was delayed because of weather for 75 minutes. I spent the time wandering E-Terminal, read an Us Weekly someone left behind at an empty gate. A janitor caught me doing it. You ever gotten a disapproving look from an airport janitor? Shrivels the testes, it does.
She grinned and shook her head.
Really, I believe you.
Then I grabbed a cup of Dunkin's, and by that point we were boarding. I got on, found out the outlet in my seat wasn't working, fell asleep for an hour or so. Woke up, read my board meeting materials, even though I knew it was pointless, and watched a movie where Denzel refused to take any shit.
That was the name of it?
In several foreign territories, yes.
She met his eyes again. There was always something in that act. You either ceded power, took it, or shared it. They came to a mutual decision to share it. She put a hand lightly to the side of his head. I believe you.
You haven't been acting like it.
And I wish I could tell you why. It's probably just all this fucking rain.
Rain's gone.
She acknowledged that with a nod. But hey, I did a lot these 2 weeks. The subway, the mall, the cab. I even walked into Copley Square.
I know you did.
The empathy in his face, the love, was so genuine it hurt.
And I couldn't be prouder.
I know you went to London.
Say it one more time.
She kicked his inner thigh softly with her bare foot. I know you went to London.
Trust is back in the house.
Trust is back in the house. He kissed her forehead.
I'm going to take a shower.
He touched her hips with both hands as he rose from his knees. She sat in the chair with her back to her laptop, her back to the river, her back to the perfect day, and she wondered if they'd been off all week because she'd been off, if Brian was acting weird because she was acting weird.
As she just pointed out to him, in the last 14 days she'd ridden a subway, entered a mall, walked into Copley Square, and trusted a stranger to drive her, all for the first time in 2 years. For most, these were tiny accomplishments, but for her they were monumental. But maybe those accomplishments had also scared the shit out of her. Every step she took out of her comfort zone was either one step closer to better mental health or one step closer to another breakdown. But another breakdown now, after so much progress, would feel 10 times as debilitating. For the last 2 years, one refrain had raced back and forth through her brain pan. I can't go back there. I can't go back there. Every fucking minute of every fucking day. So it made sense that when she engaged in acts that promised liberation at the same moment they threatened imprisonment, she might start to deflect the totality of it by obsessing over something else, something that began with a credible basis. She'd seen an awfully realistic replica of her husband in a place he wasn't supposed to be, but had clearly evolved past a rational place. He was a good man, the best she'd ever known. Didn't make him the best in the world, just the best for her. With the exception of the sighting, as she'd come to think of it, he'd never given her reason not to trust him. When she was unreasonable, he was understanding. When she was frightened, he soothed. Irrational, he could translate. Frantic, he was patient. And when it had been time for her to venture back into the world, he recognized it, and he led her there. Held her hand, told her she was safe. He was there. They could stay or they could go. He had her back. And this man, she thought as she swiveled back to the window and caught her own ghostly reflection hovering over the river and the green banks beyond, is the man you've chosen to mistrust? When he came out of the shower, she was waiting on the bathroom counter, her pajamas pooled on the floor. He grew hard in the time it took to reach her. There was some awkwardness after he entered her. The countertop was narrow, the condensation was thick, her flesh squeaked against the mirror behind her, he slipped out twice. But she knew from the look in his eyes, a kind of shocked wonder, that he loved her like no one ever had. It seemed to do battle within him sometimes, this love, which made its reappearances so exhilarating. We won, she thought. We won again. She banged her hip on the faucet one time too many and suggested they move to the floor. They finished on top of her pooled pajamas, with her heels digging into the hollows behind his knees, a ridiculous sight, she imagined, to God if he was looking, to their dead if their dead could see through time, through galaxies. But she didn't care. She loved him. The next morning he left for work while she was still sleeping. When she went into their walk-in closet to pick out her outfit for the day, his suitcase was open on the wooden rack he otherwise kept folded and stowed beside his shoes. He was mostly packed, one empty square of the suitcase awaiting his shaving kit. A garment bag hung from a hook nearby, 3 suits inside. The next trip was tomorrow, and it was one of the big ones he took every 6 weeks or so. This time it was to Moscow, he'd told her, as well as Krakow and Prague. She lifted a few of his shirts, noticed he'd packed only 1 sweater and 1 coat, the thin raincoat he'd worn on his last trip. Seemed light for Eastern Europe in May. Wouldn't the average temperature there be in the high 40s or low 50s? She checked it on her phone. Actually, temperatures in all 3 cities were expected to be mostly in the high 60s. She went back to their bedroom and flopped on the bed and asked herself what the fuck was wrong with her. He'd passed every test she'd put before him. All yesterday, after they'd made love, he'd been attentive and funny and a joy to be around, a dream husband. And she rewarded that by checking the weather report to see if he'd packed appropriately for the places he was claiming to go to. Claiming. There it was again. Jesus. Maybe she needed to double up on sessions with Jane for a while, get this paranoia under control. Maybe she just needed to do something with her time. Besides lying around imagining ways in which her marriage could be a sham, she needed to get back to writing the book. She needed to sit in the chair and not get up until she fixed whatever was causing her blockage in the Jacmel sections. She got off the bed and took the laundry basket into the alcove where they'd stacked a washer and dryer. She went through his pants, because he always left coins in his pockets, and retrieved a total of 77 cents and a couple of balled-up ATM receipts. She checked the receipts, of course she did, and found two cash withdrawals for Brian's standard fast cash amount of $200, a week apart. She tossed the receipts into the small wicker trash basket and added the change to the cracked coffee cup she kept up on a shelf for just that purpose. She went through her own pockets, found nothing in any of them until she came across the receipt she'd stolen from his raincoat over a week ago. Well, stolen was a harsh word. Appropriated, that seemed better. She sat on the floor with her back to the washer and smoothed it against her knee and wondered yet again why it bothered her. It was just a receipt from a shop in London where he'd purchased a pack of gum, a Daily Sun, and a bottle of Orangina at 11:12 a.m. on 5/9/14 for a grand total of £5.47. The address of the shop was 17 Monmouth Street, which put it just down the street from the Covent Garden Hotel. Here she went again. It was just a receipt. She tossed it in the trash basket. She added detergent to the washer and turned it on. She walked out of the alcove. She came back. She pulled the receipt out of the trash and looked at it again. It was the date that bothered her. 5/9/14. May 9th, 2014. Which, yes, was the date Brian was in London. Month, day, year. But in Britain, they didn't record their dates that way. Instead of month, day, year, they would write day, month, year. If this receipt were truly from a shop in London, it wouldn't read 5/9/14. It would read 9/5/14. She put it in the pocket of her pajama pants and made it to the bathroom before she threw up. She survived dinner with him, though she barely spoke. When he asked if anything was wrong, she said her allergies were acting up and the manuscript was turning into far more work than she'd anticipated. When he pressed, she said, "I'm just tired. Can we leave it there?" He nodded, a resigned and deflated look on his face, a martyr forced to bear the hostile caprices of an unreasonable wife. She slept in the same bed as him. She hadn't believed she'd be able to fall asleep, and for the first hour or so she just lay there, one side of her face pressed to the pillow, and watched him sleep. "Who are you?" she wanted to ask. She wanted to straddle him and pound his chest and scream it. "What have you done to me? What did I do to myself when I committed to you, when I locked myself to you? Where do your lies lead? If you're a fraud, what does that make my life?" Somehow she fell asleep, a restless sleep, and woke the next morning with a startled, "Oh," escaping her lips. While he took his shower, she went into the living room and looked out the window at the small red Ford Focus she'd rented yesterday from the Zipcar lot around the corner. Even from this height, she could make out the orange parking ticket a meter maid had slipped under the right windshield wiper. She'd expected that. She'd parked in a resident-only parking zone yesterday because it was the only way she could place the car where she needed it to be today, with a view of their garage exit. She dressed in workout clothes and a hoodie. When the shower shut off, she knocked softly on the bathroom door.
"Yeah?"
She opened the door, leaned into the frame. He had a towel around his waist, and his neck and jaw were covered in shaving gel. He'd been about to cover his cheeks, but now he looked at her, a small swirl of purple gel in his right palm. "I'm gonna go work out."
"Now?"
She nodded. "That instructor I like. On Tuesdays, she's only there at this time."
"Okay."
He crossed to her.
"See you in a week."
"Fly safe." They stood there, faces a few inches apart, his eyes searching hers, her eyes not moving at all. "Bye."
"Love you,"
he said. "Bye," she said again, and closed the door behind her. Chapter 19 Alden Minerals Limited. Yesterday, when she'd driven the Zipcar from the lot around the corner to the parking spot by their building, she'd covered a distance of 2 blocks, and even that had been a little nerve-wracking. Now, as she watched Brian pull out of the garage and drive up the ramp to street level, all the oxygen in her body pushed into her heart. Brian turned onto Commonwealth and immediately got into the left lane. She pulled out with a jerk. A cab hurtled up on her left. A horn blared. The cab veered around her, the driver throwing his hand in the air at this idiot who couldn't balance driving and paying attention at the same time. She sat, half in the parking spot, half in the lane, and heat flushed through her head and throat. Quit. The next time he goes on a trip, try it again. But she knew if she listened to that voice, she'd never do it at all. She'd spend the next year, or years, indoors, in fear, in mistrust and resentment, until those very things became a balm, an ironic salve, the worry stone she caressed until that caress replaced every caress she'd ever give or receive again. And the worst of it was that by that point, she'd have convinced herself it was more than enough. She pulled out onto Commonwealth and could hear her own breathing, never a good sign. If she didn't get it back in tempo, she'd hyperventilate, maybe black out and crash, as Brian had once predicted. She exhaled slowly through pursed lips. Brian took a left on Exeter. She dropped in behind the cab that had almost hit her as it made the same turn. She exhaled again, just as slowly, and her breathing resumed a manageable rhythm. Her heart, on the other hand, continued to scamper like a penned animal watching the farmer approach with an axe. She gripped the steering wheel like an old lady or a driving instructor, her neck tight, palms wet, shoulder blades scrunched. Brian took a left past the Westin, and she lost him for a moment, which was not the place to lose him. He had too many options there. He could loop around onto the Mass Pike, head straight down Stewart, or turn right onto Dartmouth and head into the South End. She caught his brake lights as he did just that and passed the mall on his right. She lost the cover of the cab, though, as it continued straight and she turned right. Brian was half a block ahead, but there were no cars in between them. If she got any closer, he'd be able to see her face in his rear view. She'd considered a disguise yesterday, but it seemed so ridiculous. What was she supposed to do, wear a Groucho face? A hockey mask? As it was, she wore a newsboy cap, something she rarely did, and sunglasses with wide, round rims that he'd never seen before, so she'd pass the test if he looked at her from a reasonable distance, but definitely not close up. He turned left on Columbus, and another car slid into the mix, a black station wagon with New York plates. Rachel dropped in behind it, and they continued in unison for a couple of miles. All three of them left Columbus for Arlington together, and Arlington for Albany, and headed toward I-93. When she realized they might be getting on the expressway, she feared she might projectile vomit onto the dashboard. The surface streets were hard enough, the noise, the bumps, the jackhammers breaking open pavement at a construction site, the pedestrians who dashed across the crosswalks, the other cars pressing in, cutting in front, riding up hard on her tail. But that was at 25 miles an hour. There wasn't much time to think about it, because there was Brian pulling onto 93 South. Rachel followed, feeling as if the on-ramp sucked her forward. Brian punched the gas and bolted across three lanes of traffic into the left lane, his Infiniti rocking on its wheels. She stepped on her own gas pedal, and the immediate result wasn't much different than if she'd stepped on a boulder and expected it to gallop. The small Ford inched forward, and then inched forward a tiny bit faster, and then a little bit faster again. By the time it reached the 75 miles an hour or so that Brian had reached near instantaneously, his Infiniti was a quarter mile ahead. She kept pressing on the pedal, staying one lane to his right, and soon she made up enough of the distance that by the time they'd passed through Dorchester into Milton, she had a perfect bead on him from five cars back. She'd concentrated so hard on the task at hand that she'd forgotten all her terror at being on the expressway in the first place. Now it returned, but it wasn't quite terror, just a persistent fluttering at the base of her throat, accompanied by the certainty that her skeleton might burst through her skin. And a sense of betrayal and rage as toxic as Drano. Because what was abundantly clear, though there had never been much doubt, was that Brian was not headed to the airport. Logan was 15 miles in their rear view. When they left 93 for 95 South and the signs for Providence, She considered the possibility that he could have chosen to fly out of TF Green Airport, the only major airport in Rhode Island. She'd known people to prefer it to the crowds at Logan, but she also knew for certain they wouldn't have a direct flight to Moscow.
"He's not going to any fucking Moscow," she said aloud.
A few miles later, she was proved correct when he engaged his turn signal at least 10 miles short of the airport and began to glide smoothly across the lanes. He got off in Providence at the Brown University exit, where the neighborhoods of College Hill and Federal Hill met. Several other cars chose the same exit, including Rachel's, 3 back of his. At the top of the exit ramp, Brian went right, but the 2 cars between them took a left. She slowed as she neared the intersection, let him get as far ahead as possible, but there wasn't much stalling to be done. A Porsche swung wide on her left, engine revving, and shot out in front of her. She'd never been happier for a small penis driving a small penis car to act like a small penis because she again had cover between her and Brian. It didn't last, though. At the first light, the Porsche drifted into the left-turn-only lane, then floored it, zipping around Brian as they crossed the intersection and roaring up the road ahead of him.
"Little dicks," Rachel thought again, "and their little dick cars. Shit."
Now there was no buffer between her and her husband, no way to control whether he looked into his rearview and recognized her. She passed through the intersection. She kept 4 car lengths between them, but the driver of the car behind her was already craning his head to see past her, as if to discern why she'd commit the unforgivable sin of not keeping pace with the car in front of her. They drove into a neighborhood of Federalist clapboard homes, Armenian bakeries, and limestone churches. Once, Brian's head tilted up and to the right. He was clearly checking his rearview, and she damn near stomped her brake pedal in panic. But, no, he looked back at the road. In 2 more blocks, she saw what she'd been looking for. The shoulder widened by a donut shop and a gas station. She put on her turn signal. She pulled over by the donut shop and prepared to pull right back out again as the green Chrysler pulled past her. But behind the green Chrysler was a brown Prius, and behind the Prius was a tan Jaguar, and right behind the Jaguar was a Toyota 4Runner with monster wheels, and, Jesus, behind the 4Runner was a minivan. By the time she pulled back out, not only was she 5 cars back, but the minivan was too tall to see past. And even if she could, she'd then find herself staring at the back of the 4Runner, which was even taller than the minivan. The traffic stopped at the next signal, and she had no way of knowing if Brian had actually passed through the signal before the light turned red. The traffic moved again. She followed as they continued along in a straight line, no curves in this road. "Just give me 1 curve," she prayed, "just 1 fucking curve, and maybe, just maybe, I'll be able to catch a glimpse of him." A mile up, the road forked. The Prius, the minivan, and the 4Runner all went right onto Bell Street, while the Chrysler and the Jaguar stayed the course on Broadway. Only 1 problem. Brian's Infiniti was no longer in front of the Chrysler. It was nowhere at all. She screamed through gritted teeth and gripped the steering wheel so hard it felt like she might rip it out of the drive shaft. She banged a U-turn. She did it without thought or warning, meriting angry beeps from both the car behind her and the oncoming one in the opposite lane that she cut off. She didn't care. She didn't feel fear. She felt rage and frustration, but mostly rage. She drove back up Broadway, drove all the way to the gas station and the donut shop where she'd lost sight of him. She U-turned again, this time with warning and a bit more finesse, and drove back down the way she'd just come. She looked at every side street as best she could at 30 miles an hour. She reached the fork again. Resisted the urge to indulge in another scream. Resisted the urge to cry. She took a left into a tiny lot outside a VFW post and turned back again. If she hadn't hit a red light, she never would have found him. But she did. And as she sat at it, with another gas station and a drab insurance agency to her right, she looked down the cross street and saw a large Victorian with a tall white sign on its front lawn that listed the businesses housed within. And there, in the parking lot that branched off the side of the building under a wrought iron fire escape, was Brian's Infinity. She found a parking space 6 houses past the Victorian, walked back up the sidewalk. The street was lined with old oaks and maples, the shaded parts of the sidewalk still a bit damp from the dew the trees had shed this morning, the May air filled with the scents of decay and rebirth in equal measure. Even now, approaching a building in which her husband hid the truth of himself, or certainly a truth of himself, she could feel the street and its odors calm her. The sign on the front lawn listed 3 psychiatrists, a family practitioner, a mineral company, a title company, and 2 attorneys. Rachel stayed in the shade of the great trees until she reached the alley along the side. A large sign at the entrance to the alley warned that the parking spaces were for occupants of 232 Seaver Street only, while a series of smaller signs bolted to the siding identified whose spot was whose. Brian's Infinity was parked in the spot reserved for Alden Minerals Limited. She'd never heard of Alden Minerals Limited, and yet it seemed vaguely familiar, as if she had heard of it, but she was certain she hadn't. Yet one more paradox in a week full of them. Alden Minerals Limited was on the 2nd floor, suite 210. Seemed like now would be as good a time as any to storm up the stairs and burst into the suite and see exactly what her lying husband was up to. Yet she hesitated. She found a spot under the fire escape and leaned against the building and tried to ferret out if there could be any logical explanation for any of this. Men sometimes engaged in elaborate hoaxes on their wives if they were, say, planning a surprise party. No, they didn't. At least not to the point where they claimed to be in London when they were in Boston, or claimed to be flying to Moscow when they were driving to Providence. No, there was no acceptable explanation for this. Unless... what? Unless he's a spy, she thought. Don't spies do this kind of thing? Well, yes, Rachel, a sarcastic voice that sounded like her mother's agreed. They surely do. So do cheating husbands and sociopaths. She leaned against the building and wished she still smoked. If she confronted him right this second, what would she gain? The truth? Probably not. Not if he'd been lying to her this successfully for this long. And whatever he told her, she wouldn't believe it anyway. He could show her his CIA credentials, and she'd think of the selfie he'd sent from London. How did he fake that, by the way? And tell him to take his fake CIA credentials and find a way to go fuck himself with them. If she confronted him, she'd get nowhere. Harder to admit, of course, was that if she confronted him, whether he lied to her in the moment or not, the relationship, or whatever she'd call it from here on, would leak out on the floor. And she wasn't ready for that yet. It was a humiliating realization, but at this moment she couldn't stomach the loss of him from her life. She pictured their condo emptied of his clothes, his books, his toothbrush and titanium razor, the food he liked gone from the fridge, the scotch he preferred removed from the liquor cabinet, or worse, forgotten and left behind as a reminder until Rachel poured it down the sink. She pictured the magazines he subscribed to still showing up months after he left, and her long, empty days bleeding into long, endless evenings. Since her on-air meltdown, she'd lost most of her friends. She had Melissa, yes, but Melissa was the type of friend who expected her to buck up and think positive and, "Excuse me, waiter, could I have one more of these with less ice this time?" Shake it off. Beyond that, her friends weren't friends at all, but casual acquaintances. It was hard, after all, to maintain social contact with a virtual shut-in. These last few years, her one true and constant friend had been Brian. She relied on him the way trees relied on their roots. He was her world in full. And the rational part of her knew that, of course she would have to divest herself of him. He was a fraud, and theirs was a house of sand. And yet she... He walked out of the back of the building and crossed directly in front of her. He was texting someone as he walked to his car, and she stood less than 6 feet away from him under the fire escape. She waited for him to see her, tried to think of what she'd say. He'd changed into a dark blue suit with a white shirt, silver and black checked tie, and dark brown shoes. He wore a brown leather laptop bag over his right shoulder. He climbed in the Infiniti and shrugged the bag off onto the passenger seat, still texting with one hand as he shut the door with the other. He pulled the seatbelt strap across his chest. He started the engine, still texting, and then must have hit send because he flipped the phone onto the passenger seat and backed out of the space, his eyes on his rear view. All he had to do was move his gaze down 6 inches and he'd be staring at her. She imagined the shock would be so great he'd forget he was in reverse and back straight into the light pole across the alley. But it never happened. He backed up, turning the wheel as he did, and then he was facing forward, looking out at Seaver Street. He drove out of the alley and turned left on Seaver. She ran to her car, thankful she'd dressed in sneakers as part of her workout ruse. She got in the car and turned around, drove up the street and went careening through the intersection as the yellow turned red. A minute later, she spotted him on Broadway, 3 cars ahead. She followed him back into College Hill. On a block caught somewhere between decay and refurbishment, he pulled to the curb. She pulled over 50 yards back in front of a boarded-up travel agency and a defunct record store. Past that was a furniture rental store that seemed to have cornered the market on black lacquer dressers. Next was a liquor store and then a camera store, Little Louis. Camera stores, she suspected, would all go the way of record stores and travel agencies. Liquor stores, she suspected, would hold the line the world over. But Little Louis was, as yet, hanging on. Brian entered it. She thought of walking up the sidewalk and getting a glimpse of what he might be doing in there, but she quickly deemed that idea too unpredictable to risk. This was confirmed when Brian walked back out within 2 minutes of entering. If she'd given in to her impulse, she would have been caught flat-footed in the middle of the sidewalk. He drove off and she pulled away from the curb. As she passed the camera shop, she could see that it was fairly dark inside. The windows displayed only photographs of cameras and newspaper ads taped to the glass. She had no idea what went on in that store, but she suspected selling cameras wasn't the main priority. Brian led them out of Providence, through a series of smaller and smaller towns, where the clabbered homes grew more and more distressed, and farms sprouted up here and there, until he pulled into a strip mall that appeared to be reasonably new. He drove past the Panera Bread on the edge of the mall to a small freestanding bank, pulled into a parking space, and got out of the car. He walked to the bank, the laptop bag over his right shoulder again. She idled in the strip mall lot, in front of a CVS and a Payless shoe source. While she waited, she took her phone out of the cup holder and saw that she'd received a text. She opened it. It was from Brian, and it had been sent 20 minutes ago as he'd walked out of the Seaver Street building and crossed directly in front of her. "Babe, on the runway, taking off soon, land in about 10 hours, hope you're still up when I call, love you so much." 10 minutes later, he came out of the bank but no longer carried the laptop bag. He got in the Infiniti and drove out of the lot. She followed him back into Providence. He stopped at a florist and purchased a bouquet of white and pink flowers, and her stomach turned. She wasn't sure she was ready for where this was headed. He stopped one more time and purchased a bottle of champagne from a liquor store. Now she knew she wasn't ready. He turned off the main road at Federal Hill, long an Italian-American stronghold and the seat of power for the New England Mafia, but by now just another handsome, gentrified neighborhood of chic restaurants and red-brick row houses. He pulled the Infiniti into a slot in front of one of those row houses, its windows open to the fine day, white curtains wafting in white-trimmed windows. She parked across the street and a few houses down from where he stood on the sidewalk with the bouquet in his hand. He put 2 fingers into his mouth and let loose a loud, sharp whistle, something she'd never seen him do in all their time together. It wasn't just the whistle that was new, she realized. He moved differently, his shoulders higher, his hips looser, springing off the balls of his feet with a dancer's confidence. He walked up the steps, and the front door opened. "Oh, Jesus," Rachel whispered. "Jesus, Jesus, Jesus." It was a woman who answered the door, about 35 or so. She had curly blonde hair and a long, pretty face, but none of that held Rachel's attention when Brian handed her the flowers and the champagne, then knelt on the landing to kiss her pregnant belly. Chapter 20 VHS. She couldn't remember driving back to the highway. The rest of her life she'd wonder how a completely sober person could operate a motor vehicle for several miles through a medium-sized city and not remember it. She'd picked Brian as her spouse because he seemed safe, because he was can-do, earnest bordering on grating, a man who would never cheat, never lie, certainly never live a double life. Yet she'd watched her husband enter the row house with his arm around the waist of his pregnant wife, girlfriend, and shut the door behind them. Rachel had no idea how long she sat in her car, staring at the house, enough time to note that the paint was peeling a bit from a windowsill on the second floor, the cable from a rusted satellite dish dangled off the roof down the front of the building. The window trim was white, the brick facade, recently washed by the look of it, was red. The front door was black and looked to have been painted many times over the course of a century or more. The knocker was pewter. And then she was on the highway, with no idea how she got there. She thought she'd cry. She didn't cry. She thought she'd tremble. She didn't tremble. She thought she'd feel grief, and maybe she did. Maybe this was what grief felt like, a total numbness, a brining in nothingness, a cauterized soul. The three lanes of the highway dropped to two as they crossed into Massachusetts. A car drove up on her right, attempting to cut in front of her as its own lane began to disappear. Signs warning of the lane drop had been posted for the last 2 miles. The other driver had ignored them until it was convenient for him and inconvenient for her. He sped up. She sped up. He sped up some more. She sped up some more. He pushed the nose of his car toward hers. She held her lane. He sped up again. She accelerated, eyes forward. He beeped his horn. She held her lane. In 100 yards, his lane ended. He sped up, and she gunned it, as much as a Ford Focus could be gunned. He dropped away so fast it was as if his car came equipped with a parachute. It appeared seconds later on her rear. She noted the Mercedes-Benz symbol on his hood. Made sense. He flipped her the bird and blared his horn. A balding specimen behind expensive wraparounds, cheeks just beginning to turn to jowls, thin nose, non-existent lips. She watched him rant and rage in her rear view, and definitely made out the word fuck several times, and cunt a couple more. She assumed his dashboard was speckled with spit by now. He wanted to jerk his car into the passing lane and race up on her side, then cut her off, she assumed, but the traffic to their left was too heavy, so he just kept his hand on his horn and thrust his middle finger at her and screamed in his car about what a cunt she was, what a fucking cunt. She tapped her brakes, and not a light tap, dropped her speed a solid 5 miles an hour for a moment. His eyebrows shot up over his sunglasses, his mouth froze in a desperate O. He gripped his steering wheel as if it were suddenly electrified. Rachel smiled. Rachel laughed. "Fuck you," she said to the rear view. "You nothing man." She wasn't sure the words made a bit of sense, but they felt good to say. A mile more and traffic had spaced itself out enough that the Mercedes driver could swerve into the left lane and come abreast of her. Normally, she would have looked straight ahead. Normally? There was no normal. 3 days ago, she never would have gotten behind the wheel of a car, but today she turned her head and looked at him. His glasses were off, his eyes as small and lightless as she would have expected. She looked at him steadily, hurtling down the highway at 70 miles an hour. She looked calmly at this little man until the rage in his eyes became confusion, and then guilt, and then he went for something approximating disappointment— as if she'd morphed into the teenage daughter who'd stayed out past curfew, came home smelling of schnapps and scope. He shook his head, an impotent scolding gesture, and turned his eyes to the road. After one last look, Rachel did the same. Back home, she returned the Focus to the Zipcar lot and took the elevator up to 15. Walking toward her door, she felt lonelier than an astronaut, unmoored, untouched. Floating past frontiers with no way someone could hook her and bring her back. It didn't help that of the four units on 15, her and Brian's was the only one regularly occupied. The other three were owned by foreign investors. Every now and then they'd run across an older Chinese couple, or the German financier's wife, three children, nanny, and their shopping bags. She had zero idea who owned the third unit. The penthouse above was owned by a young man they'd dubbed Trust Fund Baby, a boy so young he'd probably been learning to read about the time Rachel lost her virginity. As far as she knew, he used the place to indulge a penchant for hookers. The rest of the time, Rachel and Brian never heard or saw him. Most times she preferred this quiet and the privacy it afforded, but walking down the hall right now, she was a cast-off, a mark, a fool, something amputated from the herd, an idiotic dreamer who'd been awakened via assault. She heard the cosmos laughing at her. "Didn't you know, silly girl, that love is not for you?" The condo overwhelmed. Every wall, every angle, every view. This had been them. This had been theirs. It was all the places they'd made love, all the spots in which they'd talked or argued or shared meals. It was the art they'd picked out, the rugs, the dining set, the lamp they'd found at the antique store in Sandwich. It was the smell of him on his bath towel, the newspaper with the half-finished crossword puzzle. It was the curtains and the light bulbs and the toiletries. Some of these she'd carry into her new life, whatever that new life would be, but almost everything else felt too much them to ever comfortably become hers. To give herself a moment away from it, she took the elevator back down to the lobby to retrieve the mail. Dominic sat at his post behind the desk reading a magazine, probably a tenant's, might even be hers. He looked up and gave her a nod and the kind of bright smile that had absolutely nothing behind it and went back to his magazine. She walked into the mail room behind him and opened her and Brian's box, pulled out the stack inside. She added the circulars and junk mail to the recycling bin on the floor and was left, in the end, with three bills. She came out behind Dominic's chair and shot him a "take care," as she did.
"You too, Rachel."
As she reached the elevator bank, he called,
"Oh, I got something for you. Sorry."
She turned back, and he was going through a bin of oversized mail. He handed her a yellow manila envelope. She didn't recognize the sender. Pat's Book Nook and More in Barnum, Pennsylvania, but then remembered the VHS she'd ordered the other night. She hefted the envelope in her palm. That's exactly what was inside. Back up in the condo, she opened the envelope and pulled out the tape. The box was battered, some of the cardboard missing from the corners. Robert Hayes and Vivica A. Fox stared back at her with happy smiles, their heads tilted to the left. She was opening a bottle of Pinot Noir to accompany her when she realized she didn't have a VCR. Who did anymore? She was about to go online and see if she could buy one when she remembered they had one in storage over in Brookline. She'd have to rent another Zipcar, drive a couple of miles in rush-hour traffic. And for what, exactly? A movie that a drunk had told her to watch? She now knew her husband had another wife in another state. What more could she learn from an obscure movie from 2002? She drank some Pinot and flipped the VHS over, confirmed that the description of the film on the back was indeed the same one she'd seen posted on eBay. Above the description were two small photos. One was of Robert and Vivica talking on a sidewalk, giving each other big, toothy smiles. The other was of a young man leaning over a young woman in a wheelchair, the young man's lips to her neck, her head thrown back in delight. This must be the two supporting players, she thought. Poor Christy Gale and the guy. What was his name again? She checked the credits. Right. Brett Alden. She put her wine glass on the counter for a moment, closed her eyes. Alden Minerals Limited. That's why it had struck a chord. She looked closer at the thumbnail photo in the top right corner. Brett Alden's face was half obscured by the angle it took when he leaned into Christy Gale's neck to kiss it. You could only see his hair, dark, voluminous, and unruly, his forehead, the left side of his face, one eye, one cheekbone, half his nose, half his lips. But she knew those lips, that nose, that cheekbone, that blue eye. The hair had receded some, the skin near the temple had sprouted wrinkles. But it was Brian. No question. Chapter 21 P-380 What if he came back? She'd been lying on the couch with her eyes closed when the thought sat her up. What if he walked through the front door and he knew she knew? Polygamy was against the law. So was impersonating someone else for financial gain. However little she understood of it, Rachel was witness to a series of crimes. She suspected that men who led double lives didn't react well when exposed. She went to their walk-in closet and reached up on the high shelf where he kept some of his shoes, and behind the shoes he kept a gun, a P-380 subcompact, slightly larger than a cell phone, but a pistol he assured her would put down any home invader not wearing Kevlar. It wasn't there. She stood on her tiptoes and reached back on the left side of the shelf until her fingers touched the wall. She heard a click from the front of the apartment. Or did she? Could have been the front door opening, could have been the AC kicking on, could have been nothing at all. So the gun was gone, which meant... Nope, there it was. Her fingertips closed over the black rubber grip, and she pulled it out, knocking one of his loafers off the shelf as she did. The safety was on. She dropped the clip out of the gun and into her hand to confirm it was loaded, and then slid the clip back until she heard a click. They used to practice at a range on Freeport Street in Dorchester. Brian joking that if there was one place in the city where the locals didn't need help learning how to shoot or dodge bullets, it was Dorchester. She enjoyed the range, the crack, crack, crack of rifles in the neighboring bays, the pop, pop, pop of the pistols. She was less enamored of the brapt of the assault weapons because it called to mind dead schoolchildren and dead moviegoers. It could feel like a fantasy camp for overly aggressive children in there, most of the shooters well past the point where they needed to practice their shooting. Several just wanted to fantasize what it would feel like to actually kill that burglar, that abusive ex-boyfriend, mow down that dark horde of gangbangers. They let her try other guns besides the P-380, and she proved a good shot with a pistol, less so with a rifle, but the P-380 was a perfect fit for her. Soon she could put all 7 bullets, 6 in the mag, 1 in the chamber, center mass. After that, she stopped going to the range. She confirmed with a glance that she'd hooked the chain on the front door, so whatever sound she had heard from the closet, it hadn't been Brian returning. In the kitchen, she opened her laptop and looked up Alden Minerals Limited. It was a mining company headquartered in Providence, Rhode Island, that owned a single mine in Papua New Guinea. According to the recent assessment of that mine by a consulting firm, Borgo Engineering, the mine was sitting on resources in excess of 400 million troy ounces. A recent item in the Wall Street Journal made reference to a rumor that the dominant mining concern in Papua New Guinea, Houston-based Viterman Copper and Gold, was contemplating a friendly takeover of Alden Minerals. Alden Minerals was family-owned and family-run by Brian and Nicole Alden. Rachel found no pictures of them. She didn't need pictures. She knew what they looked like. She called Glenn O'Donnell at the Globe. She and Glenn had come up together, first at the Patriot Ledger, then at the Globe. She'd worked in investigative features. He covered business. After 5 minutes of pleasantries, in which she learned he and his partner Roy had adopted a daughter from Guatemala and bought a house in Draycott, she asked Glenn if he'd research Alden Minerals for her. "Sure, sure," he said. "I'll get right back to you." "Oh, you don't have to do..." "Be my pleasure. I'm not doing shit now anyway. Call you right back." Another glass of Pinot later, she sat in the living room by the picture window and watched night find Arlington, Cambridge, and the river. As the world turned brass and then blue, she considered her life without him. The panic attacks would return, she suspected, as soon as the numbness wore off.
All the progress she'd made in the last 6 months would vanish. Not only would she go back to zero, she feared that this series of shocks, oh, your husband has another wife, oh, your husband has another life, oh, you might not even know your husband's real name, would plunge her into free fall. Already a ball of mild hysteria clotted her windpipe when she imagined interacting with the world again, with people, with strangers, with those who could not rescue her, who would run from